Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking with Matt Barreto, who is the author of Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. I hope that you enjoy this interview. Welcome back to the podcast. Again, my name is Heath Brown, and today I have the real pleasure to talk to the author of The Big Leagues Go to Washington, Congress and Sports Antitrust, 1951 to 1989, David George Surdum. How are you doing today, Dave?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you on. I've enjoyed reading the book in the midst of a baseball season. Before we get to the actual book, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about yourself, what your background is.
Oh, yes. I'm a professor of economics here at the University of Northern Iowa. I graduated my PhD and my master's degree from the University of Chicago, writing under Robert William Fogel, Nobel Prize winner in economics, and my dissertation was on the economics of the American Civil War. Since then, I've switched topic to economics of professional team sports leagues and leisure in America during the 20th century, so I have various books on these topics, and I'm now currently working on business ethics throughout the ages.
Yes, yeah, what an enviable research agenda to get to write books like this. I think everybody kind of probably kicking themselves. Why didn't I choose to write about this issue? It's just so interesting. It must have been interesting actually doing the work for this book. The book itself is really about the three major sports in the U.S., baseball, basketball, and football. And I think it's hard for those who are sports fans now to really even imagine the very humble beginnings of each one of these sports. I wonder if you could describe a bit of the early history of baseball, for example. How was the sport organized and operated in its earliest days?
Chaos. Basically a free-for-all. They didn't really have a very formal structure. In 1871, the National Association, I believe it was a $5 entry fee. People set up their own schedules. Oftentimes, they didn't bother to play through the schedule, and it was complete chaos. The National Football League pretty much mimicked that in the early 1920s. Some of the teams played most of their games at home. Some played mostly on the road. It's not until the 1930s that they all play the same number of games. Franchises came, franchises left. And the National Basketball Association, pretty much a similar story. So there's a winnowing period. Once they achieve some success, then, of course, people say, well, it's successful. We'll try to be the interlopers instead of our own league. And then you have a lot of the interesting things going on when they're combating new leagues.
So out of this chaos comes one of the themes of the book, which is the complex ways that we might view professional sports as business activities. And this then relates to how they're regulated. So why is it so tricky to just conceptualize sports as a commercial activity? Why is this contested?
Even the Supreme Court seemed to have been imbued with this idea of baseball as somewhat mythical entity in the sense that they didn't want to tamper with it in the 1921 decision, Federal League versus the established baseball leagues. And the justices, I guess, felt that baseball was not just simply crude commerce or anything as crass as that, but it had some sort of part of the fabric, social and cultural fabric, so they were hesitant to tamper with it. But really, when you strip it down, the owners are not particularly sentimental. They may express themselves as that, but when it comes down to it, they're pretty hard-headed business people, and that's fine. I have no problem with that. It's only when they begin to bend the rules and go up against some of the antitrust rules the rest of businesses and the rest of the citizenry have to play with that I find it rather distasteful, I guess.
Right, and you're alluding to one of the first ways that the government treats professional sports, which is with this antitrust exemption. When does baseball get this special treatment? And what are the practical implications for the first half of the 20th century for the sport of getting this antitrust exemption?
The antitrust exemption never actually granted by the government, but then on the other hand, when they did take it to court, they basically de facto said, okay, well, you've been operating this way. We're not going to tamper with it. So in a sense, it was, I don't want to say a negative right, but they didn't take it away from them. And there were later court cases with the other league where they were less willing to look the other way. So most of these other leagues never had an explicit antitrust exemption, but the courts were hoping Congress would act. Congress was hoping that the courts would act because it was somewhat of a hot potato.
And so we have this period, you know, I guess the owners probably would view it as the golden age of professional sports, and the players and fans might have viewed it somewhat differently. By the 1950s, Congress starts to get involved. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about who the key members of Congress were that saw professional sports as an important federal agenda item. Who was involved in this early debate in the 1950s?
Well, I'll mention three of the more prominent ones. Emanuel Seller, the long-serving Democratic congressperson from the Brooklyn area, who won 25 consecutive elections for Congress, which would be the envy of most any sports team to have a winning streak that long. Senator Sam Ervin, of course, most people alive today would remember him more from the Watergate hearings, which came near the end of his career. And finally, Senator Estes Kefauver, a Democratic senator, well, representative senator from Tennessee, who briefly, or maybe not even briefly, aspired to the presidency in the 1950s. And they were, Seller and Kefauver were on the subcommittees on monopolies in the House and the Senate, respectively. So they were investigating various industries. And so Seller was, if I can characterize it, he seemed pretty suspicious of business owners, and he didn't seem to like the fact they were making profits. On the other hand, Ervin seemed to be fairly laissez-faire. He was certainly one of the conservative Democrats who, I presume, in 1980 might have switched over to Ronald Reagan when there was the mass switchover between the parties. And Kefauver was a fairly liberal Democrat who actually had a fairly decent civil rights record during the 1950s and 1960s. So they were interesting characters.
And during this time period, were they examining single sports or the major sports together? How comprehensive was this look that this group of members of Congress were taking?
The Sellers Committee was the first to investigate. They had a hearing in 1951 on baseball and baseball only. There were several things circulating at the time. There were television rights. There was fears about the collapse of the minor leagues. And, of course, you got this integration factor. And then finally, the demographic changes, where a lot of fans in the South and the West were clamoring for teams, which is, in fact, one of the reasons or one of the incentives for these legislators to get involved with. They were hoping to either, A, get a team, whether through expansion or enticing another team to relocate, or B, prevent their team from leaving their constituents.
And so what came of this initial round of hearings? For so long, Congress had been essentially punting on what to do. What did Congress resolve in the 1950s about some of these key issues? Which did they ultimately address, and which ones did they continue to not address?
The hearings generated lots and lots of pages of testimony. There were some statistics provided. There was a little bit of analysis, not much, but mainly there were two legislative things early on, well, not early on, in the middle of the hearing, which the book covers roughly 51 through 89, and the two major pieces were the giving the National Football League the right to sell a monopoly contract to CBS for football games, and the 1966 or 67 merger between the NFL and the AFL. Those were the two main pieces of legislation. They rarely agreed, both the House and the Senate rarely agreed to pass explicit exemptions. On occasion, one would pass it, but the other never got around to it, and they had to wait a while, and then the other would pass it, and the other wouldn't get to it. So the actual amount of legislation was pretty minimal, aside from the two NFL victories. The NFL comes out in pretty good shape on these hearings, until you get to the TV blackout, then things begin to get a little rough for them.
Yeah, and what about the labor issues? When does Congress, if at all, get involved in the kinds of labor issues that we so associate with this dimension of professional sports, issues of free agency, issues of contracts and salaries. How is that issue addressed in these various hearings and by Congress?
During the 1951 hearing, they were just a few years removed from some of the wealthy Mexican baseball owners who tried to entice major league players to go south of the border. They were hoping to create their own major league, so to speak. And some of those players initially were blacklisted, and there were threats and everything. So that was one of the issues they wanted to look at. They certainly were critical of the reserve clause because it's very one-sided. The team could release a player with, say, 7 or 30 days notice, but the player was bound to the team for life unless the team transferred the right to the player. Many of the members of the committee, being lawyers, said, well, this is completely one-sided. I think some of them called it an unconscionable contract. On the other hand, they didn't do anything about it. The owners claimed they had to have this reserve clause because it maintained competitive balance, which was always their fig leaf for covering their exploitation of these athletes. Similar to the movie star during the studio, the star system, these players were pretty much bound to one entity or one firm, and their bargaining was reduced. Therefore, it's probably a pretty safe bet to say that they were being economically exploited, even though they made more than the average person on the street, which probably was to their disadvantage in getting sympathy, because a lot of people thought, well, they're making 4 or 5 times the average earnings of an American for playing a game, which was typically the way they would characterize it. But that ignores the fact that a Ted Williams or a Jordan Mikan or an Otto Graham were very unique talent. They were the very acme of their profession, so to speak. And if they were in law or medicine, they would be making probably as much, if not more, than these professional athletes.
Now, this role of the public in these hearings and the debates and just the larger perception of professional sports really comes into the conversation in the 1980s when Congress gets involved in the issue of team relocation. What triggered congressional attention at this point, and how did Congress address the protection of local communities?
Well, dating from about the 1950s with the Milwaukee Braves getting a municipal stadium, the teams or the cities and the counties began to have more of an interest in the teams directly because they were often subsidizing the teams via the use of these stadiums on sweetheart deals and everything. And also they claimed there was some sort of economic impact from having the team in there. They would use the standard multiplier method by saying, well, if a fan comes in from out of city and goes to the game, and then maybe they stop off at a restaurant, spend $5, and then that restaurant owner will spend the $5 on another business and so on. So depending on the enthusiasm of the consultants, they could claim that these sports teams were generating large sums of money, but probably in reality they were not. However, it was the perception that the teams were being subsidized, well, not even the perception, but the reality that the teams were being subsidized and that they were providing some sort of economic benefit to the political entity that created more and more interest in having or losing a team.
Now your book ends in 1989. But we continue to see Congress involved in some ways. While it's outside of the scope of what you've written, how would you characterize the current treatment of the three professional leagues and the interest that Congress has on some of these issues? All these issues haven't been resolved. Is there any current interest at the national level in the way that these leagues are operated?
Well, there appears to be quite a bit. My guess is that the legislators are not quite as willing to look the other way, or maybe they're not as naive as they were before. During the 1957 hearing, they bring in Casey Stengel and Mickey Mantle and a bunch of other people, and even though it's just written and I don't have any visuals to watch, it appears that these legislators are just happy to trade pleasantries with these players, and they're somewhat starstruck at Mickey Mantle sitting there before them and everything. My guess is today they're a little more realistic about these entities, and they realize that they're dealing with a lot of self-interested parties here, both the owners, the players, and the fans, and the media. And they're all self-interested in this, which is fine. That's what you would expect. And the legislators, of course, are self-interested too. But I think there's probably a little bit more realism of what everything entails. And I don't think they're going to be as willing to overlook things as they were in the past. You can see that with Sam Ervin. He's very critical. And Seller was becoming more and more critical, too, especially after he realized that these owners were, lying would probably be too strong a word, but they were somewhat duplicitous. And he had become pretty disenchanted in them. He was always somewhat suspicious of them. But in the wake of the NFL merger, and then they eventually played games with television and then with the blackouts, I think the legislators were beginning to see that the owners were playing them for chumps, I guess would be a broad way to put it.
The steroid scandal and the congressional hearings, maybe the most recent, certainly back you up in terms of the treatment of the current array of stars compared to those in the 1950s. Dave's book is The Big Leagues Go to Washington, Congress and Sports Antitrust, 1951 to 1989. Dave, thank you very much for your time today.
Oh, you're certainly welcome, and thanks for having me on the show.
Our pleasure.